This is Junk Food Cinema.
Hi, this is Dick Miller. You're listening to Junk Food Cinema on Film School Rejects. Who are these guys?
Mother lovers and all those undercovers, welcome to another clandestine episode of Junk Food Cinema right here on FilmSchoolRejects.com. This is the weekly cult and exploitation film cast, so good it just has to be fattening. And ladies and gentlemen, breathe a sigh of relief, take stock of everything around you, and put a smile on that face because it is officially 2017! We did it! We made it through! We're still here! You're still here! Cargill, you're still here!
My name is Cargill. My voice is my passport. Verify me.
I want to verify Stephen Tobolowsky every day of the week.
All right, Dave Chen.
Oh, yeah, that's right. The Tobolowsky Files. That was a good podcast. I enjoyed that very much.
It was a great podcast. I love Dave Chen.
And speaking of great podcasts,
hey,
Junk Food Cinema
is occasionally all right.
We were not one of the celebrities killed in 2016. Our podcast collectively made it through to the new year. So
2016, the year that cleaned out the fucking Barney Miller room.
Wow.
It's just like Ron Glass, Abe Pagoda are still around? Gone.
And that was truly the worst thing we had to deal with in 2016. Thanks for looking at the big picture there, Cargill. If you want to look at the big picture of our broadcast history, go to Libsyn. No, don't do that. Go to iTunes or Stitcher and find our entire back catalog.
Don't do that.
Do the second thing I said. Or you can follow us on Twitter at Junk Food Cinema or like the podcast on Facebook, facebook.com/junkfoodcinema. And hey, if you really like what we're doing here, if you really want to see this podcast continue on into 2018, because Cargill's looking a little peaked over there, I'm not sure that we're going to hold on, but we're going to try. And what would help that is if you go to patreon.com/junkfoodcinema. What you can do is for a mere dollar a week, four measly bucks a month, as little as $4 a month, we will give you bonus content, and you will have supported this show continuing on into the next new year.
It's an extra mini episode a week that we do with completely different content.
Actually, it's now up to two mini episodes a week because it's a mini episode with you and I and a mini episode called The Taste Test, where you guys actually get to submit movies that I have to watch. It's like a cinematic Rochambeau, and then I record the review, which is really just me usually sitting in my car outside a fast food restaurant ranting and crying into the microphone for what I've just had to endure. It's compelling and frightening at the same time.
Some podcasts give you outtakes from their episode. We give you whole new episodes.
That's true. That's entirely true. So again, patreon.com/junkfoodcinema. We would really appreciate the extra shekels. Like I said, as little as $4 a month, and you get all this bonus content.
Yeah.
Plus this content.
Yeah, which is already free.
It's a content buffet. You will be chewing content for weeks, picking it out of your teeth.
Or like 2 hours a week.
You'll be picking it out of your teeth like Michael Sheen picks scenery out of his teeth anytime he plays a role. That is how much content we are going to give
you. That's the quality of puns you will get.
Maybe I shouldn't have said that before you put money in.
I feel like we're doing a telethon at this point. Let's move on to the episode.
Let's move on to the episode, which this week I think people are super excited about. This was one I put out a poll on Facebook, asked people to just nominate some movies that they wanted to watch, and overwhelmingly, this was one of the favorites. This
people
was a
like,
write-in.
I want Cootie's Rad Semen. I want C-Tech Astronomy.
Yes, absolutely. And we are going C-Tech Astronomy all the way with Sneakers.
They break and enter.
How are we doing?
Cause and position on the fire escape. Mother's in the cable vault.
Carrying to sever master circuit.
But they're not thieves.
We're getting too old for this.
They know your secrets. But they're not spies.
So people hire you to break into their places to make sure no one can break into their places?
What's the living?
Not a very good one.
Now they've got a new client.
National Security Agency.
I don't work for the government.
Relax, Marty. It's just everybody on your team has had some sort of problem in their past.
We don't want to bust you. We want to hire you.
We're the good guys, Marty.
Can't tell you what a relief that is, Dick.
They may not want the job.
Liz, I need your help.
I will not be dragged back into your world.
But they don't have a choice.
Your job is to find that little black box.
We got it.
is this?
There's a war out there, old friend. A world war.
Oh, my God.
How is this possible?
It's not about who's got the most bullets. It's about who controls the information.
Battle stations.
Do you have the item?
Can you guarantee my safety?
Where is the item?
Can you guarantee my safety?
Button, you've got trouble.
There's a fire escape at the end of the north corridor. Go directly north, directly north, about 30 yards.
5 seconds.
Hang up, fish! Hang up, they've almost got us!
Which is one of my favorite movies. Like, this is a travel movie. When you mentioned this to me on the list of things you wanted to do this week, I was like, I've been wanting to do sneakers for a while. As I've been traveling around over the last year and a half, I've watched this movie probably a dozen times. Like, it easily. It is an absolutely perfect, perfect thriller that does absolutely everything it attempts to do, does everything right. And every time I talk about this movie online, just subtly, you know, you throw out a little reference from this movie and all of a sudden people dogpile on because people just love this movie. And this is a movie that does not get its recognition as one of the greatest thrillers of the 90s.
I think this is, okay, if you're doing a mathematical equation, you're doing a proportional equation, for the size and scope of this cast versus the amount of love the film gets, it is inversely proportional to a weird, weird degree. This is the least beloved film with a cast this good that I have ever seen.
Yeah.
It is the least well-known film for a cast this big that I have ever seen.
And it's not a film where you can even look at it and go, okay, I get it. Like, this movie was made for people with a very specific taste. No, this is the very quintessence of what a perfect 90s Hollywood movie was. Like, this is like this amazing cast, everyone firing on all cylinders. You've got just this tight script. You've got great direction. You've got this amazing score by Junk Food Cinema's favorite fucking composer. Everything is just together.
Wait, this is a James Horner score?
Yeah.
I totally should have. I should have figured that out while I was listening to it.
Yeah, no, we talked about that in.
I completely forgot. I completely forgot this was a James Horner score. But now that I think back to it, it's like all of these really subtle horns, like every once in a while, almost like jazz. It's so unique. Like it does sound like James Horner, but then it doesn't. You know what I mean? Like it's very. It's like James Horner experimenting with jazz, and I think it really works for this movie, because this movie is the epitome of cool.
Yeah, no, this was his most experimental score where he really stepped outside of the box and delivered this very cool, chill, early 90s soundtrack, the score to this movie that just sets the mood perfectly for the type of noir that this is. And what's so amazing about this movie, the thing that really just hits me, is that this movie executes several different genres together at once to create one perfect film for which there is nothing else like it. This is a political thriller, one that was so well received that it and so widely watched in circles that it impacted American foreign policy in terms of how we dealt with computers in the early 90s and security. Like, this scared the crap out of people.
So this is the most important movie since War Games. Cargo's just tired of hearing me say that about every movie.
I really am. No, I know, but it really was something that people were like, oh shit, we need to do something about this and make sure this doesn't happen, that this can never happen. But it's also a Men on a Mission movie.
Yes.
Like it hits all of these points. You could file them away into all these categories, and it brings it together perfectly into this wonderful gumbo, which is super tight, perfectly executed. Like every line hits and carries its own weight. There's no fat in this movie.
None.
Everything just comes together. And when you realize, when you sit down and watch it, it's a 2-hour movie that blows through and feels like it's over in 25 minutes.
It does not feel like a 2-hour movie.
It does not feel like a 2-hour movie. And it's so lean at the same time for a 2-hour movie that it's just like when you start going through and realizing how much depth these characters seem to have and how little dialogue they actually have about themselves or that is in any way revelatory. Like, it's just the perfect melding of great writing and performance that really, really sells what I honestly feel is a perfect thriller. I think this movie is perfect.
Yeah, no, it absolutely is. And it's funny you mentioned Man on a Mission movie. That's probably what attracted James Horner to the project in the first place.
Dude, that dude loved Men on a Mission movies, and God bless him for it, because, man, did he... the score is... Like, you're hearing it in your head now. It's just so soft and subtle and yet driving the film. It never takes over and demands you pay attention to it. Instead, it's there... But it isn't, not in the way that a lot of modern music is, where it's, you can't remember any of it. You remember this score. Yeah. It's something that will linger. Its notes will linger in your head like good jazz, man. Like, this is, it is such a, oh man, this score. I love James Horner so much. I miss him. I wish we had more movies. More soundtracks from him, more scores from him.
Agreed.
This is one of my favorites of his, like, inarguably. Like, everyone knows that Battle Beyond the Stars and the Holy Trinity of Hornerdom is, with Krull and Star Trek II, The Wrath of Khan are my absolute favorites. This is one of the other ones that I keep over the side as a favorite.
So before we get into the plot, I want to play a little drinking game with you, Junkions. I want you to take your glass in your hand, and you're going to start drinking as I read this cast, and you'll stop when I name someone who isn't awesome. Ready? Here we go. Robert Redford, Sidney Poitier, David Strathairn, Dan Aykroyd, River Phoenix, Tim Busfield, Donald fucking Logue. Did I mention Sir Ben Kingsley and Stephen Tobolowsky? Oh my God, are you dead? I'm sorry. I'm sorry. I will write a letter to your mother, and I will tell her it was my fault. This is a ridiculous cast.
Well, and that's not even everybody.
No, it's not. It's only everybody I'm reading I don't want to spoil, because there are appearances by people in this movie.
Well, Mary McDonnell is Mary fucking McDonnell, awesome,
absolutely.
And she's in this movie, and she was not on your list, sadly.
I'm just going by the weird IMDb algorithm that arranges them. And
yeah, IMDb's algorithm of who is in this movie is always, that it's always weird.
You could do a new Abbott and Costello bit called Who's Listed First, and you would be equally as confused. So this movie begins in the 1960s, in 1969, and revolves around a character named Martin Bryce. Now, Martin Bryce in the 60s is a college student, and he and his friend Cosmo are hacking into computer networks. Now, they don't call themselves hackers. They call themselves sneakers. So sneak the planet, I guess, ? So they are moving money around illegally. They're like taking money out of, they're trying to move money out of Nixon's campaign fund into the National Association to Legalize Marijuana, and so on. My favorite is they were taking money away from 1960s Republicans to make a contribution to the Black Panthers.
Because this movie, by the way, the one thing this movie does do is it wears its liberalism on its sleeve.
Oh, really? I didn't notice.
Oh, yeah. It really is not a fan of Republicans.
I didn't notice that because the sleeve was on a sweater that was made by ethically raised yaks in certain non-exploited regions of Nepal. So, yeah, a little bit of liberalism goes a long way, as does a little bit of beer. You can tell by me trying to get that sentence out.
Wow, the beer is really tying up your tongue this week.
Man, it is just, it's tough. So what happens is the two of them are, Martin goes out for pizza, and the cops actually swarm in, and they arrest Cosmo. And we jump ahead many years, and we see Martin, who is now with a crew of people executing a bank robbery that looks super high tech and very, very collaborative, very Men on a Mission. And we are introduced to characters like Mother, played by Dan Aykroyd. And we're introduced to characters like Kreese, played by Sidney Poitier. And one of my favorites, Carl, played by River Phoenix. In one of his last roles. And is so good in this movie because it's against type for him.
Well, it's against type for him. And he's also he was one of those guys who was elevated by who was around him. Mm-hmm. And here you are with, Sidney Poitier, Oscar-winning Sidney Poitier. You're with Robert fucking Redford.
Who had to have had at least one Oscar by this point, right?
I think.
I'm pretty sure he had at least one Oscar.
At this point, he'd already started Sundance. He was already, he was just starting his Sunset years, where he still remained fucking awesome. But you've got Dan Aykroyd before he, went off into Crazy Town.
Oh, but my favorite part, Cargill, my favorite part of this movie is
the fact that he's playing himself.
Is that Dan Aykroyd's character, quote unquote, is nuts for conspiracy theories.
This LTX-71 concealable mic is part of the same system that NASA used when they faked the Apollo moon landings. Worked for them, shouldn't give us too many problems.
Now what are you saying? The NSA killed Kennedy?
No, they shot him, but they didn't kill him. He's still alive.
He is like the Jesse Ventura of this movie with how much he talks about conspiracy theories. And I just remember sitting, I was watching this going, I don't think he's acting. I don't think this is a performance, because if you've ever watched, if it's still on Netflix, good God in heaven, go find it and watch it. A special he did on UFOs that was clearly some college kid's like senior thesis that he somehow got Dan Aykroyd to be in. So they released it on Netflix, and it's just Dan Aykroyd in some sleazy motel room just like, oh, the American government actually has evidence of UFOs. He's just like chain smoking and talking fucking nonsense for an hour. And it is so delightful.
Can we get him and Oliver Stone in the same room together and listen to them talk? Like,
moderated.
Just put out a bottle of whiskey and put out two packs of smokes and just record?
I'm telling you, that has to be moderated by Jesse Ventura. It's like, well, actually, the government's had information on aliens for several decades. I actually know that where they're hiding it, it's a false flag operation. It's like, shut up, Jesse.
Wait. Why is your Jesse Ventura like a mushed mouth Walter Matthau?
Have you listened to Jesse Ventura talk? I'm just saying. Anyway.
Star Grove.
So after this heist happens, what we find out is that Robert Redford and his crew actually make a living being paid by companies to subvert their own security system so they can find the weaknesses.
Yeah.
And that's exactly what they do.
They're legit. Not really a heist, but it sure sets up the two heists coming up in the movie.
Because then they're approached by some shady government officials, one of them played by Timothy Busfield, who claim to be from the NSA, and that they are looking for this black box that's being developed by a scientist played by
Donald Logue
and his wardrobe, co-starring Donald Logue's wardrobe,
and Donald Logue in the era where Donald Logue was known for this and Jimmy the Cab Driver, like on MTV. Like, this is what he was doing. Like, this was before he got into movies.
That's
and Dr. television.
Dr. Professor Jimmy the Cab Driver, thank you very much.
Which is, and by the way, Donald Logue is fucking awesome. He's one of those great character actors that fits this perfect spot in what he's done for so long, like ever since he made The Tao of Steve. Like, he's been typecast as that, but he's so good at that. But here he is acting early on, like playing a character that is so against type for him. He's this uptight scientist that you will barely recognize as fucking babyface Donald Logue.
But what's funny, the other agent is played by an actor named Eddie Jones, and I'm watching him like, why do I know this guy and why do I feel like I like him? And turns out it's because he's like the lovable old pilot. Not Alan Arkin, but the other lovable old pilot from The Rocketeer, the one that tries to fly the plane in the clown get up and like knocks himself out and The Rocketeer has to save him. And he's like, I'm like, oh yeah, that's why I like this guy. And then he's brandishing a shotgun at Robert Redford. And I'm like, oh no, don't like you now.
Oh yeah. No, he's really the most detestable character in this movie.
Okay. I've seen people get like blackjacked with the butt of a gun and get like knocked out. I've never seen it happen three times. Like, I've never seen a movie like have somebody knocked out and then they wake up and then the immediate next scene is, what are you doing awake?
Well,
again,
the thing is not only blackjacking him with the gun, pistol whipping him, but he's without being over the top at all. You get the definite idea that this guy's enjoying the fuck out of beating the crap out of Robert Redford. Like, he just, every time he does it, he enjoys it. He's got this little smirk while he does it. It's so elegantly done. But when he pistol whips him, you just know that felt good. Like, it's really an interesting character choice and really makes you hate this fucking guy.
Yeah.
Like, Timothy Busfield, you never quite hate in this movie. like you're supposed to, but he's Timothy Busfield. He's just that really charming guy that even when the chips are down at the end and he's, you know, got the gun on him, you're like, I hope they don't kill Timothy Busfield because I kind of like him. But you know, we have not yet mentioned
a lot of people. We're very early on in this.
We are. But well, we've talked about everyone in the team.
Yes.
Except we've only briefly mentioned David Strathairn.
Yes.
Who's playing Whistler.
Because there's Whistler and Mother on the team. Do you get it?
Yeah.
Do you get it?
But yeah, but Whistler is blind and is their sound guy. And that's one of the great things about this team. And this is part of the reason why I feel this movie is perfect. Every single character has a skill set, as you have in a Man in a Mission movie. But every single character also has a defining flaw, which nails down who they are. Even our protagonist, you know, he's got that secret life and he's got the guilt of what he did to his best friend 25 years before. You've got, you know, Kreese, who, as it turns out, has a terrible temper. And you've got Carl, who's socially awkward at all points. Like,
which is such a great role for River Phoenix to play, even because he's such the cool kid in every other movie. I love it so much.
Oh yeah, yeah. No, it's like the inverse. It's kind of the inverse of James Dean.
You know, where
James Dean was this nerdy, nebbish guy who would then turn on the cool and would be super slick. Well, here we're inverting that. Like this guy who is normally playing the cool kid in all these movies, all of a sudden, you know, is, you know, this nerdy, and he's doing so great at it.
Oh, yeah.
Then, of course, we've got, as we mentioned, Dan Aykroyd, his mother, who is obsessed with conspiracy theories and seems to have Asperger's.
And potentially the worst of all Dan Aykroyd movie haircuts, which is saying something.
But it works for the character. And then, of course, you have Whistler, who is a genius techie and whose hearing is...
He's Daredevil.
He's Daredevil.
He's fucking Daredevil.
Well, they never let him do Daredevil stuff, but...
No, but he can hear, like... But one of my favorite scenes is he's got a microphone from a good 100 yards away from a building, and they're just holding the microphone toward certain rooms, and he's like... No, that window's an emergency exit. And Dan Aykroyd's like, how can you tell? He goes, oh, I can hear the batteries like resetting every few minutes. Recharging. Yeah. It's like, what the fuck?
Yeah. Yeah, but he, of
what's
course,
up, Logan?
And his thing is that, you know, he's blind. So everyone has something holding them back. And they're an oddball team. And we, in fact, get that great kind of Dirty Dozen moment,
yeah,
where it's like your team is unusual and they start reading off the crimes and the things that each one is responsible
because
for.
Because they have too many secrets.
And yeah, and it's so
hashtag too many secrets.
It's so great how we learn that everyone's, you know, got this checkered past and they're all working together at this thing and they're all really good at what they do, but they don't make any fucking money doing it. It is a fascinating setup for what then happens.
I feel like if this movie's tagline is too many secrets, Junk Food Cinema's tagline would be too many secret sauces.
Well, that wasn't its tagline. In fact, this was one of those movies that it did all right in theaters. I was really excited about it because they actually started pimping this out at like comic conventions. And
interesting. In 92.
Yeah.
Huh.
It was, and they had all of these buttons and small little posters that me and my buddy got a couple of them at a con. And the tagline, it was sneakers. We could tell you what this movie is about, but then we'd have to kill you. Which and we great. Were like, we're sold. Like, done. Like,
this movie just threatened my life. I'm in.
This movie won't tell me what it's about and threaten my life. I'm in. Like, so, you know, of course, once we saw the trailer, we're like, oh, hell yes. And then, of course, it turned out to be fucking sneakers.
Alternate tagline, which is going to play into a point I want to make a little bit later that I think is brilliant, is a burglar, a spy, a fugitive, a delinquent, a hacker, and a piano teacher. And these are the good guys.
That, you know what? I never saw that tagline. That's not a bad tagline for
this. It's a mouthful, but it's damn good. But I want to talk for a second about something you mentioned earlier. Something that definitely struck me while I was watching this movie. I am fascinated by post-Cold War spy movies.
Oh, yeah.
I am fascinated by how much that changed not only, you know, espionage, but international politics and how those two things go hand in hand. And I think this actually makes a great double feature with GoldenEye, GoldenEye is the first James Bond movie to deal with the fall of the USSR and the end of the Cold War. And the way they talk about what it means to be a spy. Now, of course, in GoldenEye, he's still James Bond. But they do definitely address the fact that it's like, there's the Cold War's over. Like, we don't really have... And then, of course, that's what makes the interesting juxtaposition to the actual nefarious plot of the movie. But watching this film, and there's a great scene where at a science conference, Robert Redford runs into a Russian diplomat, and he says... This is great. Now I'm invited over here to learn your secrets of, you know, your scientific secrets. Unfortunately, I didn't understand a word Donald Logue was saying. But it's just really fascinating to me because this movie, it kind of, when you have somebody like Robert Redford, who starred in one of the greatest spy thrillers of all time, 3 Days of the Condor.
This is the Major.
This is Joe Turner.
Identification?
My name is Turner. I work for you. Now listen.
Identify yourself.
What is your designation?
Condor.
Something has happened. Section 9, Department 17.
The section's been hit.
What level?
What level?
Level of damage.
Everybody. Dr. Lapp, Janice, Ray, Harold. Everybody is dead.
Robert Redford and Faye Dunaway in danger. And in love in 3 Days of the Condor.
Playing into a movie that feels like maybe it's going to be about post-Cold War Russian espionage, but then has kind of the same themes as 3 Days of the Condor, which is like, no, the government we can't trust isn't the Ruskies. It's kind of our own government. And then they even subvert that a little bit with like the extra twist of the movie. So
I was actually talking with another film critic about this earlier this week, because she had mentioned, it was Priscilla Page, and she had mentioned that she was watching 3 Days of the Condor back-to-back with Sneakers. And
oh, very cool.
And yeah, and I was like, you know how you have to chase that down? Fucking Spy Games.
Oh,
Tony
yeah.
Scott's Spy Games. Oh, man. My God, with Brad Pitt and, of course, Robert Redford, where Robert Redford is now the senior guy on a case, and he's the caseworker of this guy whose mission is going downhill fast. And another great post-Cold War spy movie, which I absolutely love. And we will cover eventually because we will eventually work through virtually everything Tony Scott ever touched.
Oh, for sure.
Because, dear God, Tony Scott was one of the greatest action and thriller directors of all time.
Stay tuned for a very special... that I'm not even going to say it.
We should just do a Tony Scott month sometime here soon.
Like, oh, yeah.
And that would be a great...
You know what we'd call it? Great Scott.
Yes.
Great there Scott. It is. Come on, folks. Why don't I get paid to write puns anymore?
You ever got paid to write puns?
Hey, speaking of patreon.com/junkfoodcinema, you were saying.
I was saying how badass this fucking movie is.
Yes, I think. Absolutely.
I'm pretty certain that that's what we're talking about this week. Because, like, really, the thing is, there are no flaws to excuse in this film. There is no point. I think there is one line of dialogue that is delivered humorously off note, and that is the only problem that you will find in this movie.
Go.
Ben Kingsley, when they're talking about the various things that would happen with the code box, and then he just goes, disaster.
Okay, can we talk about that's my only flaw of the movie, is the finger in the dike that is Ben Kingsley trying to hold back his own accent in this film, because he's, if you're not familiar, Sir Ben Kingsley, definitely British and not from whatever part of New Jersey he's professing to be in this movie.
Disaster.
I was just like, oh, Ben Kingsley, I love you so much, but just stop with whatever that accent is.
Sir Ben Kingsley.
Sir Ben, could you, sir, not do that? That would be sir great. But that's the big, I mean, not to spoil anything, guys, but watch Sneakers before you listen to this. So the big twist is it has nothing to do with the NSA. It has nothing to do with the Russians. It has nothing to do with the shadow government. This is a straight up revenge plot. Cosmo, who was Martin's partner that we see at the beginning. By the way, guys, Chekhov's rules of fractured friendships. If you see two people get separated by law enforcement at the first act of the movie, that's going to come back in the end. Even though Robert Redford's character mentions that his friend Cosmo, quote unquote, died in prison, you know he's fucking coming back, guys. Come on. If you've watched a movie, you know he's going to be back.
I disagree with the notion that this is a straight up revenge plot.
I think the actual plot of this movie and what they actually get embroiled in is 100% a revenge plot. In fact, Martin says to Ben Kingsley, like, you win, I lose. Isn't that what you wanted? Say it. Isn't that what you wanted? And in this, like, this moment of release where he totally, like, the veneer cracks. It's like, yes! It's like, yes, that's what I fucking wanted.
I don't, yeah, except I think he really did want the box. Like, I don't think he just wanted to challenge Martin to a game. I think he wanted the box
But he wanted to ruin Martin doing it. So I think it is as much a revenge plot as it is anything else.
That's what I would argue.
Okay,
yes.
Gotcha.
Yes. I don't think it's just a revenge plot. That's all I'm saying.
No. It's not just a revenge plot, but it is definitely a revenge plot. And that brings me to something else. Now, I said this movie was the epitome of cool. And when I think of movies that define cool for me, there are three movies I think of. I think of Sneakers, I think of Casablanca, and I think of Ocean's 11.
Yeah.
And if you watch Sneakers and you think about Ocean's 11, you will realize that Steven Soderbergh is 100% a fan of Sneakers, because so much of what ends up composing the DNA of Ocean's 11 is right the fuck here in Sneakers.
Yeah.
Right. I mean, obviously, with Men on a Mission movies, you get the sort of compartmentalization of skills. That's nothing new. But the way that these characters banter with each other, the specific way in which this feels blue collar, even though it's super high tech, and the way that the plot unfolds itself to where you have like real heists and fake heists intertwined. I'm sorry, Soderbergh loves Sneakers. There is no doubt in my mind
There are a whole host of things that Sneakers is borrowing from that I think Soderbergh is borrowing
from. But let me put it this way. Ocean's 11 feels more like a remake of Sneakers than it does Ocean's 11. If you've ever seen the original Ocean's 11 with the Rat Pack,
oh yeah,
that doesn't
the
feel
only
like
reason
the,
to watch
the
that
remake.
Movie is because of the Rat Pack.
Yeah, that movie's not good. The movie's not good, and nothing about that movie feels like Soderbergh's Ocean's 11. Sneakers, on the other hand, if you had told me Ocean's 11 was a remake of Sneakers and not the original Ocean's 11, I would have said, yeah, I can totally fucking see that.
Yeah,
100%. And at the end of the day, in that movie, it's as much about revenge. It's much about like somebody who wants to get something back that's very personal. It's about a personal stake as much as it is a financial stake. Like, they're absolutely intertwined, these two movies. And it's, I think, again, I mean, not to keep shoving double features down your throat, but that's a great double feature too. Sneakers and Ocean's 11. 100%.
Yeah.
I would watch both of those movies all day.
Look, you have also sat down to watch all three Ocean's 11s. Ocean's movies back to back all day.
I may watch one of them and fast forward, but I still watch it because
it two, right?
Yeah, Ocean's 12, I feel like, is a very hip 60s European kind of suave heist movie.
Yeah,
doesn't quite work, but Ocean's 11 and 13 are mwah, they're so good. So, yeah,
yeah, 13, we both agree, is heavily underrated.
It's very underrated, and I hate the argument, and I'm going to, let me step up here on the soapbox, okay? Nice and comfortable.
Are we really, forget Sneakers for a moment.
Yeah, here we go.
I taunted myself, the bull here for a second.
Get myself set up. Stop complaining that sequels are too much like their original movies. If you liked the original movie, and you want to see more of that world and those characters, the sequel is going to feel like the first one again, because otherwise you're betraying the things about those characters that you love in the first place. I'm sorry. It's going to happen. It's a staple of sequels. Stop acting like it defines a bad sequel. It defines a sequel. Okay, now.
And we're back. Tango.
Cash.
Let's talk about some of the greater small moments in this. Like, the thing about this movie is that the overarching plot, as we mentioned, is so taut and so well-structured and so delightful that it leads to all these great character scenes. And the character scenes are all fantastic. But one of the best ones, a scene that is just perfection in its oddity, is the scene in which we're on a date with Werner Brandis.
Oh, Werner Brandis.
Played by Stephen Tobolowsky.
Stephen Tobolowsky.
And she's trying to get him to say all of the words so that they can record him saying,
"Hi, my name is Werner Brandis. My voice is my passport. Verify me."
And she's trying to get him to say all of these words. But she can't, of course, get him to say it all at once. So she's trying out over the course of this date, and this date is going on forever. And so she's getting weirder and weirder trying to get the, because she's trying the obvious things that he's not falling for. Like, he's just, he's a socially awkward misfit. And a great character at that. Like, Stephen Tobolowsky, like, plays this sexually aggressive nerd who's also part who
somehow is not
awkward.
Wearing a fedora, which is odd.
Oh, God. Yeah, no, like, made in this day and age, he would be a neckbeard. You know, tip the hat and m'lady. Would you like breakfast? Shall I phone you or nudge you?
See, because that line exists.
And the thing is it's funny and it works. The comic relief in this movie always lands. And I think the big difference between this and Ocean's 11, which I do feel share a lot of the same DNA, is that this is a taut thriller with bits of comic relief. And I feel Ocean's 11 is a comedy overall with bits of thrilling moments. But overall, Ocean's 11, you're kind of laughing the whole way through. And it's a movie that you have to watch several times because the dialogue has to, you know, sometimes you miss it because you're laughing and there's so much great banter going on. But with this, everything is just so succinct and you're laughing at perfect moments. You're never missing anything going on. It's just always working. But then you get the release of the comic relief and then you're back in the tension again and you're dealing with, you know, their heists. And of course they've got three heists spaced out perfectly. You've got the opening heist and then you have the heist of trying to get in and get the black box. And then you have going in to get the black box again. And in between there, you've got kidnappings. You've got, you know, the setup of the heist. You've got all the stuff that you get out of all these kinds of movies. And, and it's all perfect. But this moment with Werner Brandis is just so funny and then leads to really great, awkward date number two. Like, everything with Stephen Tobolowsky in this movie is just delightfully awkward, where he's talking about, you know, what the perfect diet is. It's the bottom of a monkey cage. And, you know, and he's showing off the doggy program. Like, everything is so nice and weird. And, like, you just feel uncomfortable around this guy. And yet you like him as a film character. It's so well done. One of the other things I want to talk about, I keep missing this, so I'm going to talk about it now. Phil Alden Robinson.
Oh, yes, the director.
Phil Alden Robinson. So he's a guy who... he directed for, you know, a few years and got a couple things and then started doing like a movie every 10 years.
Yeah.
Like he did In the Mood. And then of course a little thing that, you know, we both kind of like called Field of Dreams.
Amazing.
And then he did Sneakers, which was perfection. And then he didn't make another movie for a decade.
Yeah.
And that was Some of All Fears, which is great. Underrated, you know, they kept rebooting that series.
They kept trying to make Jack Ryan a thing, and I think we were done with Jack Ryan being a thing.
Yeah, I don't know.
I think Jack Ryan barely survived the end of the Cold War.
I think Jack Ryan as a character was can still be relevant and can still be fun, but you have to tell the Jack Ryan right. In the last movie, Shadow Operative or whatever was just so bland, so it didn't work. But of the Jack Ryan movies, Some of All Fears is one of my favorites, and it's such a good one. So he did that, and then he waited another 10 years and made one of the last good Robin Williams movies called The Angriest Man in Brooklyn. But this is, I feel that Sneakers is his best movie. I like it better than Field of Dreams. I mean, of course, I've revisited it so many more times than Field of Dreams and so many more times than Some of All Fears. And Angriest Man in Brooklyn is a movie I've watched once, which I really liked, but haven't gone back to revisit. Mm-hmm. Probably because it's still kind of tough to go back and revisit a Robin Williams movie.
Oh, absolutely.
If you haven't seen it, I definitely recommend it. But he was someone that a bunch of us always talked about in the critic circles as like, why does Phil Alden Robinson not make other movies? Like that track record right there. Like, how does that guy not have made a movie every 2 or 3 years, you know? And it turns out he was one of those big script doctors like Carrie Fisher that would come in on big stuff like Shane Black and just come in and fix movies. And that's what he was doing for between every 10-year break, is he was just going and fixing other movies and while setting up doing whatever his movie was. So, but yeah, he nails it. Like, he nails it perfectly. This is an elegantly, expertly directed film that I really cannot find a real flaw with. Like, I've tried to break it down and try to see if there's any like weak link in this movie, and there isn't. It is a movie, like we've mentioned all those things, that comes down and also has what I hold to be one of the five greatest cameos of all time.
Yes. Shall we discuss?
Let's jump into the end of this movie, because we're coming towards the end of the podcast. The end of this movie is so perfectly set up and happens so well. Like, you, it's one of those things that you should have caught it the first time you watched it. You should have known. You should have recognized that voice on the phone, but you didn't, because every time you're zeroing in on the voice, Whistler comes in and goes, they just got this satellite. They just found Tokyo. You got 20 seconds, Bish. Like, so you're not like sitting in and zeroing in and paying attention and able to focus. Mm-hmm. So that when the voice on the phone shows the fuck up and it's James Earl fucking Jones,
you're like, why didn't I recognize Darth Vader on the phone with Robert Redford?
Yeah. Like, it was, and cause even the cameos at the end of this movie are fucking amazing. Like, yeah. this is up there. Cause I had this discussion recently, and this is one of those that I'd love to sit around and pick your brain on at some point, but I was sitting around drinking with a couple of friends and I just asked what the greatest cameos of all time were.
See, the problem with that discussion, which is, I think, great, but man, you can ruin some movies doing that. You know what I mean? Like, you just having that discussion, it's like, what about this one? Oh, wait, you didn't see that?
Well, yeah. Look, when you're talking about of all time, what do you mean you haven't seen Robin Hood, Prince of Thieves?
Yeah, I guess that's true. Yeah, I guess if you go back. But I guess the first two that jumped to my head are so recent that it's like, okay, 21 Jump Street's cameo. I guess you could do it that way.
You know,
so
what? People mention 21 Jump Street.
The cameo in 21 Jump Street is so good because I don't care who you are, you did not fucking see that coming. You didn't recognize him there the entire time.
I would argue that the greatest cameo of all time is Marcel Marceau in Mel Brooks' Silent Movie.
Because he speaks. That's the funny part.
Would you like to be in my silent movie? No.
The only thing
this moment, the moment the light comes on and it's James Earl Jones, and then the scene that happens, like the frustration of James Earl Jones trying to get this fucking box. They've got machine guns on these guys.
Yeah, and they're making demands. Like, you want the box? I want my record expunged. Oh, yes, and I would like to take my wife to Europe. Oh, yeah, and I want a Winnebago. And then,
With the machine gun.
Oh, River
Phoenix. Can I have her number?
I love that scene so much.
Oh, God,
she's like,
moment?
I'm sorry, hold on, I'm going to stop you. You could ask for literally anything you want, and you're asking him for my phone number, and he's like, yeah, and she just gives it to him. It's so good.
Yeah.
So good.
Oh, and then he takes off the cap and messes up his hair, and he's just like, he stammers,
greasy, and but he's like, still the best looking guy in high school.
I'm going to be sick. And but the thing is what's so great about that scene is funny, but that scene also nails home something that's never really said in it, but is perfectly relayed. The reason why this scene's allowed to happen is because these guys really are the good guys.
Yeah.
They're not there to kill them. They're not technically supposed to be there. There's actually a line that people believe is in this movie that isn't in this movie because they confuse this with The Hunt for Red October.
Yeah.
Because people are, you know, none of this ever happened. And I was never here.
I was never here.
Which is not, that's Hunt for October. Which is great, because that's what was interesting about this movie at the time it came out. It felt like a weird pseudo sequel to Hunt for Red October, the Jack Ryan movie that then Phil Alden Robinson would then go into. And I'm wondering if maybe it's entirely possible that Phil Alden Robinson had done some script doctor work on Hunt for Red October.
It just occurred to me that James Earl Jones, Timothy Busfield, and Lee Garlington are all in this movie.
Yep.
And they're also in Field of Dreams,
which was directed by Phil Alden Robinson. Yeah. No, he was one of those guys that worked with the same dudes, mm-hmm. Which is not at all strange. That whole sequence at the end, it's just so heartwarming and fun and great. And then it gets political for half a second again. And then it's over.
Yeah.
But
how political can you get? How political can you get when earlier in the movie you made a joke about rat semen? That's, I feel like you got two
cooties rat semen.
Cooties rat semen. When they're trying to break the what do you call that? Anagram. They're trying to break the anagram to figure out what AG was it? I can't remember what it's.
C-Tech Astronomy.
Too many secrets. Too many of them. Get rid of some of them. But I want to go back for just a second to something you said about Phil Alden Robinson being one of the great script doctors in Hollywood, kind of behind the scenes secretly. It feels very fitting that this would be a movie because of that we're talking about this week, when we just heartbreakingly lost Carrie Fisher.
Yes, who is also one of the great script doctors.
Behind the scenes, one of the great script doctors who, most people don't know this, but drastically changed the dialogue for movies like Hook, Lethal Weapon 3, Sister Act, The Wedding Singer, and nobody knew this.
And supposedly Harry Met Sally. I've seen everyone's been quoting those movies because those are the ones that have been mentioned publicly. But the story that I had always heard for years was that they were having problems with When Harry Met Sally, and they brought her in to fix it. And she completely revised the script. And in doing so, they realized, well, we have to have Carrie play the best friend now. Mm-hmm. And then they were like, well, then we'll have to have her, you know, her foil be Bruno Kirby. And that's how they ended up in the movie.
And of course, and this is great if you find these images online, a little movie called The Empire Strikes Back.
I've heard mixed things about this, actually. This has been something going around that these images are of her script notes. And I've heard that they're actually Kirshner's. Erwin Kirshner's script notes.
I feel like I haven't seen that refuted anywhere though. So
I've seen a couple people talking about it. So I won't. I cannot. In all, you know,
we're going to pretend to have a conscience now. Really, this show.
Not have a conscience. I'm just going to say that
this show with I can't.
Well, you know what? I don't want to pull another boner. We've pulled a couple boners recently, so.
Stop telling people, hey guys, go check out this thing that might not be legit. I'm going to ask you to stop telling people about pulling boners on the air, because it sounds like we are a Dutch Rudder podcast, and I don't want to give people that impression.
I don't know. We might get more downloads that way.
Too many secrets.
Too many secrets.
Put the nitro back in the box.
Don't give me a hard time for pulling a boner when you had...
Stop saying things that I could make into more dirty jokes. I will not give you a hard time about pulling your boner. I'm just going to softball that in for you. Hey-o, what were we talking about? So another thing I wanted to mention.
Sneakers.
Robert Redford, I didn't realize this, but we were talking about the connection between this movie and 3 Days of the Condor, and there's actually a really specific one. Apparently, in 3 Days of the Condor, when the CIA building is hit, there's a list of casualties displayed. The last two names on that list, and they're just last names, the last two names are Martin and Bishop. That's a direct. His name in this movie is a direct reference to 3 Days of the Condor.
That would not surprise me.
And he's wearing the same leather jacket in this movie that he wore in The Natural. This is like the Robert Redford greatest hits movie. All your favorite Robert Redford movies now in one film. Sneakers. We're the good guys. Trust no one. I love the fact that at the end of this movie, they set it up where, even though, you know, Ben Kingsley doesn't have the box because he forgot to, you know, look in the box. Even though they've quote unquote, given it back to the American government and gotten all these rewards for it, there's still this onus that they have upon them. This, you know, they don't want to be responsible for whatever evil this, and by the way, I don't think we've mentioned what the box is, but it's a code breaking, it's basically a code breaking algorithm machine but the only way it works is because Russia and America use different codes, they figure out that the only thing it really works on is American codes.
Yeah.
So it's really for spying on our own people. So again, you have the 3 Days, the Condor type
which of reference. Which the NSA gets a hold of, oddly enough.
Why? Why, Snowden? Why is that a bad thing?
I don't know. Is that not good? I don't know. At the NSA listening to everyone and being able to decode everything, so weird and prophetic.
Look, without this tying into future events, how would Oliver Stone make mediocre movies to this day? Cargill, explain that to me. Without devices like this, how is Oliver Stone still employed?
He could still make movies about the things that excited him when he was 14, like he did in the 80s.
Oh, you know what? Walter Hill did that in Streets of Fire, and that turned out pretty well, so maybe I shouldn't complain about that.
Yeah.
It's all about the information.
So that brings us to the junk food pairing. And this is a real, now stick with me on this kind of situation, because
You've built this up for me.
And you're just going to have to trust me on this one. Hey, Cargill, you're going to have to trust me.
Too many secrets.
This week's junk food pairing is Captain Crunch cereal.
Oh, no, this isn't a stretch at all. That's fucking genius.
Because there's That's a scene slick. In this
Hit
movie.
Him. Hit him.
There's a scene in this movie where Dr. Brandis, who's, of course, played by our main man, Stephen Tobolowsky, he's going to be going on a date, and they're trying to find any information that they can about him. So Dan Aykroyd goes through his trash, and one of the things he holds up is a half-folded box of Captain Crunch cereal. And then later in the movie, there is another Captain Crunch reference, and it's like, what? Why do they keep making all these Captain Crunch references? Yep. It's because there was a phenomenon called a phone freaker that happened before the age of digital phones, where there was this little whistle that was a prize in the 1970s in Captain Crunch boxes. And what somebody figured out, it was actually a guy by the name of John Draper, who is not a secret code name for someone from Mad Men, actually. He called himself Captain Crunch, and he discovered that if he blew the whistle into a phone,
because it was a
high frequency,
2600 megahertz or something, or what,
yes.
Whatever the, yeah, it's because 2600 then became like the hacker thing in the 80s and 90s as a result of Captain Crunch. Like, yes. That was like 2600 was code for phone freaking, which, yeah, you'd use this whistle, you'd blow the whistle into the phone, and it would that was the tone that the phone was actually getting from the coins, and you'd have unlimited long distance.
And they actually do this in Hackers, and it's like a super big deal in Hackers that they're able to get free and then it was always something that when I first watched Hackers, I didn't understand why do they care so much about getting free fucking phone calls? Like, why is it such a big deal in the movie? And it's because it's a reference to one of the original, you know, massive hacks of the country, which was John Draper's phone freaking.
Yeah.
And that's exactly, because
when that started getting out, like that whole group that started phone freaking were the first hackers. And so those guys then, as computer stuff started coming up, moved into computers and moved into hacking. And yeah, no, so that's deep lore. So yes, I appreciate the Captain Crunch reference. I give you a big high five on that choice.
If you also enjoy that reference, take out your Captain Crunch whistle and blow directly into your iPhone. Nothing will happen. But thank you so much for joining us on this week's Junk Food Cinema. Before we go, one more fun fact about sneakers. The building that they are in, and they're at the beginning of the movie, the young Robert Redford and young Ben Kingsley, and when they're doing their pranking, the facade of that building is the famous Hill Valley Clock Tower from the Back to the Future trilogy. Ah. So another strange movie connection there. But we have been Junk Food Cinema. I hope you've enjoyed our sneakers episode. If you would like to hear more episodes, you can go to iTunes and Stitcher for our entire back catalog. You can follow us on Twitter at Junk Food Cinema. Like the podcast on Facebook, facebook.com/Junk Food Cinema. And while you're there on iTunes, please rate and review us. That helps us move up. We've gotten some really nice reviews lately. I want to thank you guys for that. And if you really like what we're doing, patreon.com/junkfoodcinema. I can't stress this enough. For as little as $4 a month, you're going to get bonus content. You're going to help this show continue on into the new year. Cargill, where can people find you on the interwebs if they haven't hacked into your profile already?
Twitter.com/massiveworm. That's MASSAWYRM. And facebook.com/massiveworm.
Awesome. And you can find me on Twitter at BryGuySalisbury, or my Facebook page is facebook.com/BryanSalisburyCritic. And before we go, I just want to remind you that it's not about who's got the most bullets. It's about who controls the information.
Too many.